Iran says the era of hit-and-run attacks by Israel is over, warning the regime of a crushing response if it harms Tehran's role in Syria. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says Israel is responsible for everything that happens in the Gaza Strip as the regime continues to blockade the territory and carry out attacks. And Britain's finance minister says the novel coronavirus has put enormous strain on the British economy. Thanks so much for being with us. Iran has warned Israel of a crushing response if Tel Aviv attempts to harm Tehran's advisory role in Syria.
Iran's presence in Syria is advisory, and naturally, if anyone disrupts this advisory presence, our response will be a crushing one.
Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman said Israel is well aware that the era of hit and run is over, and therefore it is moving very cautiously. He said Israel's aggressive nature is irremediable and called for resistance against the regime. Israel has claimed that it has targeted Iranian military sites during its recent attacks on Syria. Iran says its military advisors are in Syria to help government forces in their anti-terror campaign. Let's cross over to Ontario, joined by author and journalist Robert Fantina. Robert, thanks so much for being with us. Your take on Iran's response to this situation so far and telling Israel that the situation is very different now and that this is a different time and era.
Israel has been given fair warning. Israel is supporting terrorists who seek to overthrow the government of Syria. Iran is working against those terrorists in support of the Syrian government, which it is allied with, and is doing so is completely legitimate. Israel's support of these terrorist organizations and its bombing of Iranian or of Iranians who are in the country assisting Syria is certainly a criminal activity. But as the Iranian spokesman mentioned, Israel doesn't care about such things. Its violent nature is well known. It will continue to support these terrorists until Syria and Iran and some other allies are able to drive them out. They've made great progress in doing that and will continue to do so despite what Israel does.
What do you think the reason is for these increased attacks by Israel on Syria?
Israel sees any nation, any independent nation in the Middle East as a threat to its existence and to its more than that to its power. Several years ago, at the time when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State in the U.S., she said the best thing the U.S. could do for Israel is to destroy Syria, and the U.S. has attempted to do that for these last several years. Israel recognizes now that with the outgoing Trump administration that its license to do anything it wants anywhere in the world is coming to an end. Not that Joe Biden will put many brakes on Israel's behaviors, but this freedom to do anything, to bomb anybody, to steal any land, to kill anybody, is drawing to a close. Mm. So that's why it's currently being more aggressive now against Iran in Syria.
Well, it's interesting you said that, because, I mean, if we look at even previous American governments, whether we're talking about under Obama, yes, on the surface he dealt with Israel a bit different, but at the end of the day the same thing was taking place. Israel was basically creating havoc wherever it wanted to, and also assassinating people. So, I mean, does it really make a difference for Tel Aviv, who's sitting in the White House in Washington, when basically it appears very much that they have, to say the very least, a lot of control over both the Republicans and the Democrats?
Yes, Israel does have a lot of control over both parties in the U.S., and it hasn't made a big difference in the past. U.S. administrations have always been extremely supportive of Israel for reasons that are completely inexplicable unless you look at the amount of money that pro-Israeli lobbies donate to members of Congress for their election and re-election campaigns. We are seeing a difference now. There's been a crack in that surface of that unilateral support or universal support for Israel. Progressive Democrats are questioning Israel far more than they have in the past. Some of them have publicly supported the boycott, divest, and sanction movement. So Israel knows that the handwriting is on the wall. Biden is a Zionist, of course, as is Harris, his vice president. But they do have a strong and growing wing of the Democratic Party that they must appease. And that party is concerned about human rights and is concerned about international law, something Biden and Harris have always ignored. But once Biden is in the White House, it will be more difficult for them to ignore it. Okay. This does not mean to imply that there'll be a significant change, but there is some hope that Israel will be reined in to some limited degree at least.
Thanks so much for being with us out of Ontario, Robert Fatina, author and journalist. Well, Iran has called for the removal of sanctions against Syria, particularly during the coronavirus pandemic. Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif called the sanctions cruel. He also criticized certain countries for undermining the political resolution of the crisis in Syria. Zarif said several good opportunities to resolve the crisis arose in recent years, but he added they were squandered by those countries. Now, the top Iranian diplomat was speaking in Tehran during a meeting with the UN envoy for Syria, Geir Pedersen, for his part underscored Iran's cooperation with the United Nations to solve the crisis in Syria. The Arab state has been targeted by Western sanctions in recent years while grappling with foreign-backed insurgency. Israeli forces have conducted aerial and artillery strikes against the Gaza Strip. Following that, Palestinian resistance movement Hamas said Israel is responsible for any escalation. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed the issue in detail. Let's take a listen.
Time now for the news review program. Stay with us. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has slammed the Israeli attacks on the Gaza Strip, saying that the regime is to blame for new escalation. Hamas spokesman Fawzi Barhoum added that Israel is responsible for anything that happens in Gaza because of its continued blockade and attacks on the coastal enclave. Barhoum stressed that the resistance is only acting in self-defense and a veiled reference to rocket fires from the Strip. The Israeli military conducted air raids on the cities of Gaza and Khan Yunis overnight. Tanks also hit a Hamas outpost in the town of Rafah. The Tel Aviv regime claimed that they were responding to rocket fire from the Strip, though no Palestinian group has claimed responsibility. Israel has conducted similar strikes on Gaza Strip over the past months. Now let's get some of our guests' opinions on this. So joining me will be Natalie Strecker, activist and campaigner with Jersey Palestinian Solidarity Campaign, joining us out of Jersey, and also Jafar Ramini, Palestinian writer and political analyst, joining us out of London. Let's go to Jersey first. This has been for months. It's not the first time. And Israel has been doing this and targeting different areas in Gaza at different points. Some civilians getting killed. It's not only Hamas positions. I want to ask you about the reason behind this. And Israel doesn't seem to want to stop this.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, there has never really been a true ceasefire, not since the last full-scale assault on the area. Why Israel keeps doing this, that's a million-dollar question, isn't it? I believe if you look at everything else that's kind of happening around Palestine at the moment, I believe it's an attempt on Israel to really force the Palestinians to capitulate in its entirety. And also to, I think part of the issue is probably around trying, because there is a building of solidarity with the Palestinians, obviously, there aren't two sides to this story. I believe part of it is a campaign to try and destroy that by forcing the Palestinians to react in a way that they lose favour, perhaps, in different groups, etc. Beyond that, it's really difficult to tell, because obviously Gaza doesn't really have an army. It's got some rudimentary rockets. It can't really defend itself, but it's been under a legal blockade for, brutal blockade for over a decade now. Yeah, it's a very difficult one, to be honest. It's such a difficult thing to be observing, especially because Israel continues its crimes with impunity.
Right. Now over to London. Mr. Ramini, this has been going on for months, and Gaza has been under siege for years. And you know what the situation is like there, mainly describing in the largest open-air prison. Do you expect an escalation? I mean, given this point in time, Trump administration gave the largest open support to Tel Aviv.
We've been expecting this for the last few days since that rocket was fired towards the southern settlements in occupied Palestine. And the Israelis were making jokes of it, that because there was some thunder in the area, and that we should expect more thunder from Hamas. The Israelis don't need a pretext to hit Gaza. As you said, they've been besieging Gaza since 2007. And they have waged war three times. The last was in 2014, with more than 3,500 Palestinians killed. Hamas should do one thing. Either declare themselves either as a Palestinian resistance fighters or politicians. They cannot keep these channels of communications with Israel through Egypt, through Qatar, through whoever it is, and pretend to be a fighting force for the liberation of Palestine. These rockets, so-called, are causing more damage, more harm to Gaza and to the infrastructure in Gaza than it is doing to Israel. Because every time one of these rockets is fired, either by Hamas or Islamic Jihad or whoever is based in Gaza, Israel blames Hamas and tells the international community we have to respond because we are defending ourselves, you understand. The other thing, Hamas has to agree to whatever terms Mr. Abbas in Ramallah offers them to leave out any doubt who is selling Palestine, Hamas or Fatah, because who pays for this is not Hamas or Fatah, is the Palestinian people in Gaza under siege, and the Palestinian people in the West Bank under a different kind of siege called the Palestinian Authority. So for us, the Palestinians, is a lose-lose situation.
Okay, thank you very much for your comments. We had Natalie Stecker, activist and campaigner from Jersey, Palestinian Solidarity Campaign, and also Jafar Ramini, Palestinian writer and political analyst, who joined us from London.
Well, the Center for Human Rights in Yemeni province of Taiz says children's rights are being violated due to Saudi atrocities. The center said more than 850 children in Taiz have either been killed or injured by Saudi attacks. It said the attacks have also destroyed scores of schools, while the rest have turned into military bases used by the enemy. The Taiz Human Rights Center slammed the international community for its silence and held it responsible for the violation of the Yemeni children's rights. Saudi Arabia launched its war on Yemen back in March of 2015. The conflict has killed tens of thousands of people, mostly civilians.
With almost 100,000 children under the age of 5 at risk of dying, Yemen slides into a dire situation. Here lies the 9-month-old Munir struggling to survive a severe malnutrition.
Munir Nabil.
This is my son Munir. We've been here for a week. We want to treat him for malnutrition, and God helps us. We're resisting this savage war.
The ongoing war and siege imposed by Saudi Arabia has brought a severe famine described by the UN as the worst humanitarian crisis in the world.
There is an increase in malnutrition cases. Yemeni children are suffering from malnutrition in all governorates, and we receive 50 to 60 cases per day. There is a shortage of medical equipment like CT scanners.
The UN's former humanitarian coordinator for Yemen described the country's food security status as catastrophic. Now, a UN analysis shows that the coronavirus pandemic, economic problems, and the war have pushed malnutrition the highest levels in some parts of the country. According to the UN study, malnutrition has risen 15% among children under the age of 5 this year.
We condemn and denounce the continued international silence about the blockade imposed on Yemen and the failure to take any measures against the Saudi coalition, which has exacerbated human suffering, especially for children.
Millions of children in Yemen could be pushed out of starvation by the end of the year, as the humanitarian crisis is compounded by the ongoing war and the blockade, along with the pressure of funding shortage as the world grapples with the coronavirus pandemic. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Afghanistan's Vice President Amrullah Saleh has pledged to bring to justice those responsible for Saturday's rocket attack in the capital, Kabul. Saleh said the government will also find out the networks who facilitated in transporting the materials used in the attack. He said 10 people were killed and another 51 wounded. Officials said at least 23 rockets hit several densely populated districts, including in and around the heavily fortified Green Zone. Several buildings were damaged, including the Iranian embassy and a medical complex. The Daesh terror group claimed responsibility for the attack. The British finance minister says there will be no return to austerity in an upcoming spending plan, despite problems caused by the COVID pandemic.
You will not see austerity next week. What you will see is an increase in the government spending on day-to-day public services, you know, quite a significant one coming on the increase that we had last year. So I think there's absolutely no way in which anyone could say that's austerity.
In an interview with Sky News, Sunak said the British economy is experiencing enormous strain and stress. He said a public pay freeze can happen. Sunak said large employment fluctuations are among the main issues to be considered in the government spending review next week. Britain has suffered its biggest economic crash in more than 300 years due to the pandemic. The country is the hardest hit European state by the disease. Britain has so far confirmed more than 54,000 deaths out of 1.5 million infections. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization warns of a third wave of the coronavirus in Europe early next year if governments don't address issues needed to prevent the spread of the disease. WHO Special COVID-19 Envoy David Nabarro said European governments must build the necessary infrastructure to prevent a third wave. Nabarro noted that the governments had missed prevention steps during the summer after bringing the first coronavirus wave under control. He underlined that such a failure caused the ongoing second wave of the disease on the continent. Europe saw a reduced caseload for a brief period, but infections are again wreaking havoc ahead of the winter holiday season. And with that, brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. A
According to a new analysis, nearly 12 million jobless Americans would lose federal benefits the day after Christmas unless Congress passes extensions for key unemployment programs. Currently, there are two active key government programs authorized by the Coronavirus Aid Relief and Economic Security Act, or CARES Act, but both expire on 26th of December. One program is the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program, which provides unemployment aid to freelance and temporary workers. According to a study by the Century Foundation, if it expires, 7.3 million workers would lose their benefits. The study shows the other program is Pandemic Emergency Unemployment Compensation, which, if expires, would deprive 4.6 million workers of their needed income. We now present you an article written by Christopher Rugeber. The piece is titled, U.S. Jobless Claims Rise to Nearly 745,000, Millions to Lose Aid. The article has been taken from the website of the Associated Press. Stay with us for more of Christopher Rugeber's article. The number of Americans seeking unemployment aid rose recently to about 745,000, the first increase in 5 weeks, and a sign that the resurgent viral outbreak is likely slowing the economy and forcing more companies to cut jobs. The worsening pandemic and the arrival of cold weather could accelerate layoffs in the weeks ahead. Of the roughly 20 million Americans now receiving some form of unemployment benefit, about half will lose those benefits when two federal programs expire at the end of this year. Rubila Faruqi, chief U.S. economist at High Frequency Economics, a forecasting firm, said, "The risk of further job cuts and income loss is high now from business operations being curtailed." She added, "Also, expiration of federal benefits later this year will put renewed strain on household incomes. Overall, the labor market remains under stress." The U.S. Labor Department's report on Thursday, 19th of November, showed that applications for jobless aid rose from 711,000 in the previous week. In March, when the pandemic first intensified, the number had soared to 6.9 million. Before then, applications typically hovered about 225,000 a week. The surge in confirmed viral infections and worry about its effect on the economy are putting pressure on the financial markets. The Dow Jones Industrial Average declined in early trading on Thursday, 19th of November, for a third consecutive day. The economy's modest recovery is increasingly at risk, with newly confirmed daily infections in the U.S. having exploded 80% over the recent weeks to the highest levels on record. More states and cities are issuing face mask mandates, limiting the size of public gatherings, restricting restaurant dining, closing gyms, or reducing the hours and capacity of stores and other businesses. At least 15 states have tightened curbs on businesses to try to slow the spread of the infection. Evidence is emerging that consumers are losing confidence in the economic outlook and pulling back on shopping, eating out, and other activities. Spending on 30 million credit and debit cards, tracked by JP Morgan Chase, fell 7.4% earlier this month compared to a year ago. That marked a sharp drop from 2 weeks earlier. According to a University of Michigan survey, consumer sentiment also declined in early November and is down nearly 21% from a year ago. and retail sales rose just 0.3% in October, the smallest gain since stores reopened in April after a nationwide shutdown in March. The weak gains suggest that consumers began pulling back on spending even before many new restrictions on businesses were imposed. The government said recently the number of people who are continuing to receive traditional unemployment benefits fell to 6.4 million from 6.8 million. Some of that decline reflects more hiring, but it also indicates that many jobless people have used up their state unemployment aid, which typically expires after 6 months, and have transitioned to a federal extended benefits program that lasts 13 more weeks. Yet, according to a recent report from the Century Foundation, that extended benefit program is one of two federal supports that are set to expire at the end of this year, eliminating benefits for 9.1 million people. The U.S. Congress has so far failed to agree on any new stimulus package for jobless individuals and struggling businesses. The cutoff of aid will sharply reduce income for the unemployed, force a further reduction in their spending, and perhaps weaken the economy. Of those programs is Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program, which made self-employed and contract workers eligible for unemployment aid for the first time. The PUA, the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program, was established by a multi-trillion dollar aid package that Congress enacted in the spring. The second measure in the stimulus package provided the additional 13 weeks of benefits for unemployed people who have used up their state benefits. When those two programs expire on 26th of December, the Century Foundation estimates that 12 million people will lose their benefits. The report said about 2.9 million will probably transition to a state extended benefit program that can last from 6 to 20 weeks. The rest will lose their benefit that average about $320 a week nationally. The expiration of benefits will make it harder for the unemployed to make rent payments, to afford food, or keep up with utility bills. Most economists agree that because unemployed people tend to quickly spend their benefits, such aid is effective in boosting the economy. Cutting off benefits with so many people still receiving them would be unusually early compared with previous recessions. Currently, there are two active key government programs authorized by the Coronavirus Aid, Relief and Economic Security Act, or CARES Act, but both expire on 26th of December, the day after Christmas. One program is the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program, which provides unemployment aid to freelance and temporary workers. According to a study by the Century Foundation, if it expires, 7.3 million workers will lose their benefit. The study shows the other program is Pandemic Emergency Unemployment Compensation, which, if expires, would deprive 4.6 million workers of their needed income. Andrew Stettner, who co-authored the study with Elizabeth Pancotti, said, "Absent congressional action to extend CARES Act benefits, 26th of December will mark the end of one of the last lifelines available to millions of Americans in desperate need." Andrew Stettner added, "It will be a crippling end to one of our darkest years." The study projected that 2.9 million people will be able to continue receiving benefits from state-level programs called extended benefits, but that will require that states pitch in to cover half the costs in 2021. the expiration of the programs will leave millions of Americans without any unemployment benefits, which only cover a fraction of prior income. Another program which added $600 a week to unemployment checks across the board expired at the end of July. Andrew Stettner said people don't realize that most of the people collecting unemployment benefits now will be cut off on 26th of December, adding, most people will be going from that $200 to $300 a week to nothing. This will have a huge impact on families and on the economy. Meanwhile, several other pandemic-related programs will expire at the year-end. For instance, a moratorium on evictions and a program to provide forbearance on mortgages are also due to expire by the end of 2020. According to Oxford Economics senior economist Bob Schwartz, the end of aid programs would provide a real test for the U.S. economy. Bob Schwartz wrote in a report, with infection rates spiking throughout most of the nation, so too are more restrictions being put in place, setting the stage for the unemployment lines to swell again. Adding, unless Congress extends jobless benefits, a vital source of income for this distressed segment of the population would be extinguished. The coronavirus pandemic, which hit in March, has left millions of Americans unemployed, and many more could lose their jobs as COVID-19 surges across the United States, sparking new restrictions from states and cities. The unbridled spike in recent weeks has brought new caseloads to over 150,000 a day on average. In the Great Recession of 2008-2009, the U.S. administration extended unemployment benefits to 99 weeks, and the additional aid lasted throughout 2013. When that program ended, about 1.3 million Americans lost benefits, a fraction of the number who would lose their aid at the end of this year. Elizabeth Pancotti, co-author of the Century Foundation report and a policy advisor at Employ America, a left-leaning think tank, said, "We're still down 10 million jobs since the pandemic began," she added. "We're heading into the winter. We're seeing additional business closures. Consumer demand is already falling. Cutting off benefits seems inhumane to me." In March and April, when the pandemic erupted in the United States, tens of millions of people applied for jobless benefit. Though many of them have been rehired or have landed new jobs, those who haven't found work began exhausting their 6 months of state aid as early as September. Most of them would then shift to the Pandemic Emergency Unemployment Compensation Program, which provides 13 additional weeks of unemployment support. Yet the Century Foundation estimates that 3.5 million people will have used up all of those 13 weeks before the end of this year. An additional 950,000 people will have run out of the 39 weeks provided by the PUA program by then, too.
Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the documentary, we went to Singapore, an island city state off southern Malaysia, where 5.2 million people call home. Singapore is a global financial center where 1 in 4 have a university degree and 90% own a home. By all counts, Singapore is prosperous, rich, and safe. But this is not the whole story. A 2010 survey shockingly revealed that over 9% of women in Singapore experience physical or sexual abuse from their partners, and 1/3 of these domestic violence victims have a college degree. We followed the stories of Rachel, Mira, and Vu as they shared their experiences of abuse, victimization, and shame. But as bad as violence and abuse is for any woman, and the situation is much worse for women who are migrants living in a foreign country, as we shall see in the rest of the program.
In 1994, Vu met and married her Singaporean husband in Ho Chi Minh City. She was 21 and he was 41. Shortly after, Vu and her husband returned to Vietnam so that her family could help look after the baby. This was when his true nature was exposed. Hoping for a better education for her daughter, Vu agreed to move back to Singapore. That was 15 years ago. Vu's husband's addiction to gambling often led to fights, but she learned to hit back. Although she could defend herself physically, he had other ways of punishing her. To remain in Singapore, Vu required a long-term social visit pass, which was renewed yearly. This visa requires a guarantor, her husband.
The law recognizes that when someone hurts you physically, threatens you, confines you, harasses you, then that's a violation of your rights. The law does not state that if when someone abuses you verbally, emotionally, that's a violation of your rights. And so protection under the law may not be extended to the individual under those circumstances. But does it make it right? Of course not.
For the first few years, Vu was financially dependent on her husband and mother-in-law, but she slowly worked her way to independence. To make ends meet, she sold donated clothes at the Sungai Road street market. For the past 4 years, Vu has held a stable job at a fast food restaurant. With help from charities and aid agencies, her children's education is paid for. She is the breadwinner now, but her husband still holds some of the cards. Vu wants to leave her husband, but first, she needs to make sure that her right to reside in Singapore is secure. In 2 years, Vu's daughter will be 21, the required age to become her mother's guarantor in Singapore. It's the promise of the life that comes after that keeps Vu going day by day. Whether or not her dream can become reality remains to be seen.
Some foreign spouses will find it difficult to get citizenship or PR because they don't have a lot of education and also are married to men who themselves don't have a lot of education, lowly skilled, and they are seen as not being able to contribute that significantly to the Singapore economy. Because our immigration policy is very much tied to one's economic or potential economic contribution, the chances of getting the PR or citizenship are not so high. I think the immigration policy should definitely be reviewed. One, there should be some criteria so that foreign spouses can work towards making sure that in time they can actually acquire citizenship. Two, there should be some points given, you know, and a lot of points given for the fact that they have children in Singapore. And if the children are Singapore citizens, it really doesn't help the family that their mother has got such a uncertain citizenship status.
Victims of domestic violence transcend race, income, and educational background. 1 in 3 victims in Singapore have a university degree, and they are even more likely to stay silent.
there's a lot of victim blaming still going on, you know. And the very fact that people still think that, you know, I'm washing dirty linen, you know, in public when I talk about these things, you know.
Why have we still not come to a point in society where people are willing to intervene?
It's a private matter. It's between a husband and a wife. You should not interfere.
That domestic violence is a private matter. It's a...
Okay, we don't know all the facts. There's another side of the story.
I think the reason that that's so difficult, and I think you hit on two things that are really important that I think are sorely lacking right now in our society, which are one, empathy, and two, imagination. Mm-hmm. And in Singapore, these are two qualities that are not at all considered to be that important.
Once there were only two. Then it became four. Soon there will be six universities in Singapore. And more than 48% of university graduates are women. Both Rachel and Mira are professionals in the marketing industry. And like many other successful women, they have struggled with the issue of shame.
I didn't want people to know that, you know, I was like one of the statistics, you know, abused wife, and then, you know, the pity, and then, you know, the whispering, the gossiping and all that. I really didn't want any of that. So I very stupidly, you know, just kept it to myself. I didn't say anything. You know, I just put it all upon myself, you know, to try to solve the problem.
I didn't want my family to feel that I've married a terrible person, nothing. I wanted him to be respected. I didn't want to go to my family and say, this is what my husband is doing to me.
According to the International Violence Against Women survey in 2010, almost one in three victims in Singapore have a degree or postgraduate credentials.
The fact that we found a disproportionately higher number of women who were victims of violence who had university or postgraduate qualifications hammers home the point that education alone is not enough. We have done well economically, we have done well in terms of, you know, earning capacity. But in terms of how we are as a society, our values, what we see as important, perhaps there's a lot more room for improvement.
Why did these professional women stay silent?
So educated women will feel that they should be able to handle anything that happens in their family, right, including violence. And so they are not going to readily tell another party. In fact, they often try to deal with it themselves, and they are less likely to tell their friend or family member because they're much more embarrassed.
It's not just got to do with the income and the education, but really a lot has got to do also with the beliefs that we hold.
Shame, embarrassment, saving the family honor.
Perhaps it has something to do with the fact that when I think about drawing attention to my problems, I draw attention to not just shaming me as a person, but shaming my family, my community.
But if victims remain silent, do family and friends have the responsibility to speak out? That is Robert's dilemma. He has known Luke and Lena for 30 years.
I actually did not believe that he would do such a thing. So when she told me about it, she said, I don't think I want to be with him. So I told her, well, give yourself a bit of time, think about it.
Robert never imagined that his friend could be a wife beater.
We always tell him, if you've got a good wife, then just, you know, control yourself. Oh no, I love my wife. I love my wife very much. I will not do such a thing. But we can see, you know, a few times when I myself and my spouse met this couple, you could see on her face the black and blue marks hidden under the makeup.
When Robert accepted that his friend Luke was an abusive husband, he offered help.
I tried to help her by asking her if she needs any, you know, advice from lawyers, if she needs to get away from him. You know, we could help her find a place.
But fear has kept Lena under her own roof.
If she were to leave him, she thinks that she will lose whatever she's put into the home. And she may lose her son also.
Family violence professionals believe that the community has a larger role to play.
Violence will only stop if the society actually is more proactive, because it is really the people around the victim that have much more choices than the victim, much more choices to do something about the problem.
For most people, the hardest part is knowing when to take action and how far to go.
I have this fear factor in me that what happens in their home behind closed doors is very private. And the fear is, if I were to actually interfere in their private affairs, it may backfire. So either party has to make the first step.
Without an explicit cry for help, Robert feels he cannot act further.
If she comes to me physically and says, look, this is what has happened to me, with all the bruises and all the black and blue marks on her face or arms, I would personally think that I will bring her to a police station to make a report. But she has never at one time said, yes, help me, or I will follow your advice. So I'm in a very difficult position to report this matter to the authorities.
When is the right time to act?
There's something called the battered wife syndrome, and there are people who have been in victim mentality for many, many years, right? And the children see it, right? But are powerless, right? And so I think in some cases, you actually need to allow people like their children or even social workers to help them take that first step and to initiate the process, because otherwise they will continue to be in this situation.
Now that her son is about close to 30 years old, he's still single, she did bring this subject up to him and ask him that, she told him that one of these days I'm going to walk out of the house. I hope you will not blame me and you will support me. His answer to her regret was, this is a problem between you and Dad. Don't get me involved. It really broke her heart. And she said all this while she's been living in the home for the son, yeah. And now with him saying this few words to her, she was really very disappointed.
So what do you think were Shu Wei's beliefs, though?
At workshops run by advocacy groups like AWARE, gender stereotypes are being questioned.
You should be submissive.
I accept.
You should be a housewife.
You should be able to cook.
It's your job to look after the children.
You should keep the family together.
I accept.
Breadwinner.
I accept.
Macho.
You shouldn't cry.
I accept.
You're always right.
Whoa. I accept. You are a role model. I accept.
Without a shift in societal attitudes, responses to domestic abuse remain unchanged.
There are three typical responses when a person is confronted with domestic violence. One is to deny that it exists. Turn the other way. Don't deal with it. The other is to acknowledge it exists, but to minimize it. To say that this is a once-off thing. To say that it only affects the poorer community, the less educated, the migrants. And when these two initial responses isn't adequate, the third response is always to blame the victim.
Hearts, minds, attitudes. These are the keys to shaping a better future.
So you can do case management till the cows come home. Every case, you empower the woman, you give her all her options, and then she finds a solution, right? But it just keeps happening. So until you try to change, until you change the societal attitudes, it's going to continue, and you're just going to have cases continue all the time. Yeah, so we really have to, even though it's long-term, it might take 10 years, even more, but we have to start somewhere. Yeah. So this is the driving force behind the weekend campaign. It's the first time that we're actually doing a campaign that lasts more than a year, but we think this is necessary, right? So we plan for at least a 3-year campaign. him, say, if it has to be a community effort, right? So we are really just a catalyst. We provide the tools, and we try to inspire people to think about the problem and how they themselves can be part of the solution.
I would like to encourage others to not submit to other people's expectations of you.
My change is to remind people of their freedom of choice and their right to choose.
My change is to start believing in myself well. Then I think I can help others believe in themselves as well.
Mine was not a physical abusive relationship, but it was more mental and psychological that slowly deteriorated my sense of self-worth over that 24 period time frame. So I think that what, as a woman, I would like to do is reclaim my sense of self-worth and then teach my daughters what it means to be a powerful woman.
When I share my story, you know, people will say things like, what did you do? Did you do something to make him behave that way, you know? There's a lot of victim blaming still going on, you know. And the very fact that people still think that, you know, I'm washing dirty linen, you know, in public when I talk about these things, you know. But I'm very fortunate in a way that my children are very supportive of what I do. They are very proud of the work I do, you know. The more I see this, the more I feel that, you know, I should share that there's really nothing wrong in facing our demons, you know, straight on.
Mira, too, is no longer a victim.
Every day for the rest of my life, when I look into the mirror, I'm going to see that scar. But it's a scar that will tell me that I tried. I tried really hard. I got into a relationship eyes wide open with hope. However, I used to look at it and cry. Not anymore. I look at it and I feel brave about it and I tell myself I survived. I survived because of very strong family support, really good strong friends who made sure that I was going to be strong, accepted me, allowed me to cry. I came out of a toxic marriage. Today, if I see a woman get beat up by a man, I will go and help the woman. I don't care how big that guy is going to be. I don't care if that guy is going to use vulgarities on me, but I would go rescue that woman.
Today, Rachel proudly stands her ground and openly tells her story so that other women don't have to face the same ordeal alone.
Is there any other point?
You always feel that, you know, why is this happening to me, you know, especially when you look around and, you know, people are having happy marriages, happy families, you know. And you will feel like, you know, you're so alone in the world, you know, that it's only happening to you. And that's the reason why I'm speaking out about this, you know, so that other women will know that it is not only just happening to them.
Perhaps breaking the suffocating silence is the first step in ending the issue of domestic violence and abuse. Women enduring such horrific conditions must find the courage and strength to speak out and seek help. And that's it for this week. Do join me again next time here on Aperture. But before we go, remember you can contact us either through email, Facebook, or Twitter. Goodbye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.